Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the weekly news show, peeling back the headlines, looking at bits and shards of the truth that lies beneath them. I'm Kevin Barrett with Professor Anthony Hall, Professor Emeritus, I should say, back on the show that he's been such a huge part of for the past few years. So, hey, good to have you back, Tony.
Great to be here, as usual.
All right. Well, we only made half our target, so I have to beg for money. So people, if you don't give us money before the end of this show, in fact, very, very soon. See, this is a copy of Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddama, an 8-volume series in Arabic. I'm going to start reading this from cover to cover. That's all you're going to get. And if that doesn't work, we're going to have Tony read the statute books about Aboriginal treaty rights in Canada. And you guys are going to pay up fast.
Speaking of the statute books, I want to make it clear that I do this as a public service. Kevin, I appreciate your work, and I do hope that the 200 a week, which is sort of bare minimum, continues to support you and your family, and the amazing work you've done to support yourself and alternative media through generating income. Symbolically, it's very important that somebody do that. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Tony. I appreciate that. And I appreciate your carrying the fight for truth and justice straight into the heart of the academy and putting up one of the great all-time fights for academic freedom, which I think you won, basically. Anyway, here we are in our free speech zone, False Flag Weekly News. We're not out in Death Valley. Sometimes it feels that way, but no, we reach thousands of people, and please help us reach more. Spread the word. All right, let's get moving. Speaking of reaching more people, I'm now a regular over at the UNS Review, so people can check my work out there. We were getting a podcast put up there. I think the UNS Review is one of the really go-to spots in the alternative media world. What do you think, Tony?
Stop the press. Major headline. Kevin Barrett.
All right. Move on. Next slide. Okay, well, the point was that the article I submitted was, worth talking about. We talk about conspiracy theories here from a viewpoint that's not the one that you get paid for to talk about in the academy. So here was my kind of long think piece reviewing three books on conspiracy theories, including this, the new Bible on conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theories and the people who believe them. And I've tried to get the editor, Joseph Yuzinski, to come on the show and talk about this with me, but I haven't heard from him yet.
Well, this is an important article. You've read three books, and that takes time, and then you've put together an essay describing your impression of these three works and how they integrate together. One of the points you made is that those who ignore dissident voices, conspiracy theories, if you like, that they tend to have muddled thinking, that even if the so-called conspiracy theory that is part of the discussion is wrong, the very idea of people having open discussion, including a variety of perspectives and possible scenarios of how things happen, this is how thinking is advanced. But instead, we get this kind of effort to crush thinking and deteriorate the quality of public discourse, especially in the academy right now, which is, you know, a beehive of political correctness and censorship and, politically correct doctrinaire thinking coming down to the students who are told, you know, you want to get a job, learn to keep your mouth shut, say the preferred orthodoxy. And this is a big problem in our society right now.
Absolutely. Well, the book that you mentioned here, Charlene Demuth's book, In Defense of Troublemakers, which a very kind audience member had sent to me, I think makes this really crucial point, which is that having this kind of hardcore dissent, a really different dissenting opinion that is expressed passionately and tenaciously, actually, even if it's wrong, that creates better deliberation and better decision making. So we really should be encouraging so-called conspiracy theories and other passionate forms of dissent, especially if they're, you know, well done. And that's an issue that I don't think this world of studying conspiracy theories in the academy has really figured out yet. And this could save the world, Tony, because we're deliberating on very important stuff like, will we build new nuclear weapon systems that are likely to go off? And the next slide We see that the INF is dead. Europe is a step closer to nuclear war. This was a South Front article published at VT. And I thought this was a pretty good rundown of sort of an introduction to what's going on with this INF treaty. Tony, this is bad news. This puts Europe in the crosshairs of Russian missiles that can hit them within not just minutes, but seconds.
Well, generally speaking, we're seeing this week the news stories mostly selected by you. We're not seeing too much evidence of false flags. We're seeing what we've been reading about for some time, that it seems the big powers, the ruling groups, are returning back to more traditional militaristic agendas of, you know, countries, super states, countries being platforms for various kinds of militarism. And what we're seeing is trade wars, yes, but especially tech wars. And we'll see this with, you know, discussion of cell phones, but we're seeing it with the treaties on ballistic missiles, intermediate range. What do they call it? The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which is being abrogated. And of course, these treaties go back to the kind of love fest that took place between Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev in the final stages of the Cold War.
Yeah, it makes you actually miss Ronald Reagan. You know, I knocked on doors for the nuclear freeze movement in the mid-80s because I was afraid that Reagan was going to blow up the world. And it turned out that he became actually something of a peacemaker compared to what's come since then. Well, the next story from Dmitry Orlov, really good stuff from him. I should get him back on my radio show. So here he is giving a kind of a passionate pro-Russian interpretation of what's happened here. He says Russia has won. He says actually this is in the strategic interest of Russia, which now can hold Europe hostage. And Europe is going to flip, and they're going to enter the Russian-Chinese Eurasian orbit and leave North America at the margins of civilization. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I was interested to come across this new person to me, Dmitry Orlov, and this is his blog. And as I understand it, he's an American-Russian, a Russian descent working in California in engineering. And he, you know, looked at the demise of the Soviet Empire and considers that the U.S. Empire is going in the same direction.
Yes.
And it can happen very quickly. I was particularly fascinated with this Poseidon weapon, this drone, this torpedo drone. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Orlov writes about it, and there's a lot of attention. This is part of the Russian effort with all of these treaties controlling the arms race being put by the wayside. And the theory is U.S. is actually wanting to deal with China and is saying that Russia committed all these contraventions of the treaty. But it's really U.S. trying to free itself up to deal with the military threat, growing military threat, nuclear threat posed by China. But along comes Russia with this Poseidon fantastic torpedo, apparently, which is nuclear armed, which can go a mile underwater, which can go 200 miles an hour, which can traverse oceans, apparently, could make the, say, the eastern seaboard of the United States kind of just disappear and be flooded with tsunamis. And it's a horrifying weapon. It's a difficult, you know, to say the least, situation that we got ourselves into with the demise of the Soviet Union. There was a decade there, and people were saying, we've got to come up with a way of thinking about our economics that isn't, you know, spin-offs off the war machine, which is what we've been doing for a long time. And we didn't really come up with any alternative model of economics. And it's like the system is just going back to what it's familiar with. Putting all its treasury into developing weaponry, and we, the citizens of the world, get a little bit of spin-off here and there from consumer articles derived from this military research.
Absolutely right. Yeah. I'm having Ellen Brown on my show tonight. We'll be talking about possible alternative economic models that could work a lot better, how China has improved living standards and really it's rocketing to the front of the class globally based on a different kind of banking system, and we could build an even better one. But we'll talk about that in a bit when we get to that story. But speaking of China, how about the Huawei thing? This was actually the Washington Post admitting that it was scooped by yours truly and False Flag Weekly News. We were talking about this, obviously, this kidnapping of the Huawei executive. What was her name? Wang
Waozhu.
Okay,
Ms. Meng. I've heard her referred to as Ms. Meng. They put the family name first.
Right.
So you
Canadians went and kidnapped her under American orders, apparently, saying it was about busting Iran's sanctions and stealing technology. But the real reason, according to the Washington Post, echoing what you heard first on False Flag Weekly News, is that this is about China being way ahead in 5G technology and other key technologies.
Yes. Well, this to me is a real tragedy for Canada and a mark of Justin Trudeau's ineptness. As I see it, Canada's position in the world right now depends on cleverly and cunningly playing China off against the United States. And both countries, you know, have a big part of our economy right now and compete. And we should be sort of putting out friendly feelers to both parties and playing them off against the other. That to me seems to be our fate, but we've taken sides in the situation here and egregiously offended China and the Chinese business community. These cell phones, it's an amazing reality to conjure with. You know, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence, we're going to talk about spying, we're going to talk about, you know, how much of the human destiny comes down to what goes on in these cell phones. And the G5 technology of these cell phones, well, the health risks are enormous. And we really have no idea how these electromagnetic rays, frequencies, energies affect the human person. But we
actually have some idea, Tony, and it's it looks really dangerous, but that's been suppressed.
Yeah, and so this new technology is being sort of forced upon us, and there you emphasize a Washington Post article saying that, you know, China is way ahead. They have, you know, you need much more dense concentration of delivery for this G5 system. It's going to bring about, you know, automatic driven cars and all of this stuff, and it's going to make for an enormous new possibilities, including artificial intelligence, which is really bad news. Elon Musk is leading the crusade, surprisingly, against artificial intelligence, just giving it a blank check. It's part of the war machine. So at the center of this whole thing is a huge technological sort of confrontation, really. Some say it's not really a trade war, it's becoming a tech war. And as I say, we're not really looking that much at false flags right now. We're looking at big competition between big, powerful interests, including big, powerful countries. And of course, Huawei in China, because it's an authoritarian regime, because the government is centralized and it's a one-party state, they can coordinate their efforts in G5 and are, you know, outflanking the United States in this new technology. Cell phones are really like a new technology. I see it. You know, they're beyond laptops. Something happened once you put these supercomputers that you can put in a pocket. You know, something really changed in the way our socioeconomic system is designed.
But Tony, I think that blaming it on centralized Chinese authoritarianism is really not even half the story, because the issue here is that China has a central bank that can, you know, all central banks create money out of nothing. And in China, it's created out of nothing by sending it to build infrastructure projects for the national interest and the benefit of ordinary people. In the West, it's created out of nothing by a cabal of private central bankers who are drowning us all in debt for their own power. And they are not directing their investment towards strategic ends or towards building better infrastructure or helping ordinary people. That's what Ellen Brown's going to come on my show tonight to talk about on Revolution.radio. That show runs from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
Well, I think It's the first time I've heard you, Kevin, speak as if you have authority on the Chinese banking system. And I can't really say that I do, but my understanding of how China became the kind of dynamo of capitalism, a communist country, how ironic, is it was kind of a Rockefeller project. It was kind of a hobby, almost, it seemed, of David Rockefeller. And there were reports he was going to China all the time. So you have the banking cabal. I don't know, is China got a different, is it outside the central bankers, the BIS system? I doubt it.
Well, we'll have to ask Ellen. I have discussed this on my show with Ellen in the past, and she says that, yes, indeed, the Chinese banking system is much more under state control and state planning than the U.S. banking system is. And it's perhaps there is a private element there, but I don't think it's as owned by the Western cabal as the Western banks are. But I can ask her tonight. Maybe you could even call into the show and ask her if you want.
Well, of course, this. Well, we can move through some stories, but I'll talk about the Canadian banks.
Yeah. No, let's dive into that tonight. If you're free tonight, Tony, while Ellen's on my show, somewhere between 8 and 10 Eastern, maybe you could call in and ask a couple of hard questions. So speaking of China, I wrote a piece for American Free Press looking at kind of the larger broad strategic issues of China rising and the pluses and minuses. I mean, this normal strategic thinking tends to be a zero sum game. And that's leading us into the Thucydides trap, where the rising power is condemned to go to war with the dominant power. This has happened over and over and over in history. Three quarters of the time in this situation, you end up with a huge war between the two leading powers. So can we avoid that? Hopefully. And maybe if the West could see that there's a good side to China as well as a bad side, that would help. And so I did mention this great new book by Andrei Volchek and John Cobb, one of my intellectual heroes and 9/11 truth supporting theologian philosopher, about Chinese ecological civilization and these tremendous strides China's been able to make in cleaning up its act over the past decade, thanks to adopting this policy of ecological civilization and having the state-controlled bank to loan money for the kinds of projects that clean up the country.
Well, I wasn't able to read this article ahead of time because I'm not a subscriber to American Free Press, although I follow that venue and it's important. China's rise is, you know, one of the really surprising developments of our time. Of course, you know, the strategic balance of power lies in, you know, you have these three powers, USA, Russia, and China. And who are the two that are going to get together and form an axis of real collaboration? Whoever those two are going to leave the third one out in the cold, in a way, in the most menaced situation. And it seems that the U.S. is right now is doing everything in its power to drive Russia and China more closely together, which is the worst possible scenario for the United States' best interest.
It seems like very bad strategy. Plus, the 9/11 triggered war on Islam has just distracted the U.S. from real strategic concerns and real important projects like cleaning up the world. Moving on to Iran, though, the war in Iran seems to be distracting the American policymakers to no strategic or otherwise rational ends. And we have the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution happening pretty much right now. The Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran on February 1st, 1979, and the revolution was completed on February 11th. As he basically took power, his people totally beat the Shah's people, and we've had this alternative civilization in charge in Iran ever since. It's quite an amazing story. And in this article, I argued that this is the model that Muslims should be thinking most about, not these crazy, you know, Salafi, jihadi, al-Qaeda, ISIS caliphates and craziness like that. But just look at what Iran's done and just think about how the Islamic world could achieve greater things by not necessarily slavishly imitating the Iranian model, but by thinking about the core principles of independence, speaking truth to power, and really a total commitment to doing the right thing.
I think you're referring to the article on Nasrallah, where you comment on Press TV. Should we move on to that?
Yeah, sure.
That's the slide of that story.
Next slide, yeah.
I think, okay, if you would like to talk about this, and then I have probably my most significant contribution to the show today would be on this topic of the 40th anniversary. So talk about yourself here, if you like, on Press TV. And
well, I just echoed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah's point that the Islamic Republic of Iran has achieved amazing things. And we never hear about that in the West. You know, from what was it, maybe 2/3 literacy, 60% literacy under the Shah to universal literacy today, very weak female literacy under the Shah today, universal women's education, women dominate the universities in Iran on the various quality of life and human development indexes. Iran does extremely well. They went from 200 universities under the Shah to over 3,000 today, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there have been these great achievements, but because they're socialist type achievements for the most part, the West doesn't notice. All the West notice is that the capitalist comprador bourgeoisie that usually gets rich by exploiting its own people in countries dominated by the Western banking system is not doing that great in Iran. They think they could do better, and that's why they, you know, there's that element that wants to change the system.
Well, there's a great disparity of wealth in Iran, and there's some very, very wealthy people in Iran.
Compared to what?
Iran. Compared to all over the world. I mean,
Iran is less unequal than most other places, Tony.
Okay, well, this gets into what I want to address here. You know, I think it's fair to say, Kevin, that when it comes to being the spokesperson for the Islamic Republic of Iran in the United States, you're the main one.
Somebody would hire me and work out a salary for that. On the other hand, they'd probably arrest me like they arrested Marzia Hashemi. So I'll just keep on calling it the way I see it for free.
Yeah. And, you know, and I want to have an opportunity to expound a little bit here. I know I'm noted for sometimes droning on, but occasionally ideas take a bit of explanation. So I'm going to put that out there that when it comes to explaining Iran in the United States, you're the major voice and you're dependent upon. And the fact that you're doing the official story to go along with, you know, the leader of Hezbollah on the 40th anniversary to explain the achievements of Iran, good for you. You know, we need such a voice. But here I am talking to you right now on the 40th anniversary. And I think it's appropriate to give a little alternative perspectives on this and to point out the fact that you're not in an average situation on this story. You are pretty much the voice. Who else is there in the United States who speaks as you do about the Iranian Revolution? Now, 1979, we're 40th anniversary. Let's recall that there was Jimmy Carter supported the coming into power of the Ayatollah Khomeini to replace the Shah of Iran. And, you know, he came in a big Air France 747. And there was a certain amount of international support for this very, dramatic shift, which was to give some kind of international sanction to an Islamic government. And so what is that all about? How do we see that in retrospect? What was really going on? And I draw to your attention 1979. You know, there were other things going on, like the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism, where the global war on terror was basically being, you know, mapped out and the discourse was being planned. This was led by Benjamin Netanyahu and his father, Benzion Netanyahu. That was going on in 1979. Also, Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, he was giving the go-ahead to create a Muslim proxy army, a jihadist force to overthrow the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan. And this was very dramatic politics at the time. This was quite a leap into the dark. So I would suggest 1979, the framework of this global war on terror was kind of being put into place. It's almost like there was a consciousness that the Cold War wasn't going to be perpetual, that the Soviet Union would disappear and something would have to be put in its place. So this change in 1979, of which the Islamic Revolution is a part, I have questions about what are the deep state politics going on in 1979. There's my speech, and I'll end it there.
Yeah, I agree. Very interesting deep state politics. Well, Brzezinski wanted to use Islam as a weapon against this communist Soviet Union, and that worked pretty well. And the Islamic Renaissance exploded, and the possibility of that alternative Islamic civilizational model suddenly was out there. And I think that scared the powers that be. So the backlash was the war on Islam that we've seen since the false flag on September 11th, 2001.
What really seemed to frighten the United States was the more secular regimes, especially that of Nasser in Egypt and the pan-Arab movement and Qasem in Iraq and Saddam Hussein in Iraq and more recently al-Assad in Syria, these more secular approaches to pan-Arab unity and state creation and such really seem to spook the dominant forces in the U.S.-led Cold War.
So why did they throw all their support to Iraq in its attempt to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran during the 1980s?
Okay, well, you've got me on that one. But they also set up Saddam Hussein they eventually took him down.
They took him out, Tony, as a step towards going after Iran.
And now we have a Shia government. We see the use of Islam as a ploy to fend off communism. And of course, that would be the reasoning in 1979 that, well, what if we get a communist government in Iran? Well, if we get a religious government, religion by its very nature is not going to be materialistic. It's not going to be dialectical materialism. It's not going to be socialism. So the exploitation of Islam drive the war machine, I mean, this is a subject that is, I think, worthy of some discussion.
Okay. we probably should do the long
maybe
version
we can't
of that
do it here
on,
because,
on a radio show, yeah.
Well, keep in mind, Tony, we'll discuss it somewhere else some other time.
Yeah. Let me give you two basic rejoinders, though. Number one, that the entire 1980s was one huge attempt by the U.S. and the West to destroy the Islamic Republic of Iran by arming and financing Saddam Hussein. And number two, the only reason that they went in and took out Saddam Hussein was so they would have military bases that they thought they could use to get Iran. That's been made very clear. Iran was the seventh country in 5 years, and the whole purpose of doing it, Iran is the country that scares the Zionists. So that's what all this has really all been about.
You might remember a little thing called Iran-Contra that, scandalized the United States. And it turns out that the United States was also supplying arms to Iran secretly.
They wanted to keep that conflict going and cause destruction. Yeah. But the vast, overwhelming amount of support was for Iraq. That's like saying that the U.S. supported Hitler in World War II. Well, yeah, we did to a certain extent.
It would have been impossible without U.S. support.
We supported Hitler that much, and we supported the British that much. And the same thing is true of the Iran-Iraq War.
Not when it came to Wall Street. The whole thing would have been not viable if it hadn't been Wall Street building up this National Socialist government in Germany in the 30s.
In the first place, right. But that was not the war. Anyway, moving on to the war in Venezuela, we're seeing war on everybody pretty much these days. We've seen Russia, we've seen China, we've seen Iran, and now the war in Venezuela is a war again against these forces of an emerging multipolar world. Pompeo saying that Hezbollah is running rampant in Venezuela. This is kind of humorous. So the war on Iran moves to Venezuela to humor Pompeo and Bolton. They can't get Iran. They said that Iran was going to be run by the MEK terrorist group before the anniversary. That didn't happen. So now they have to go after Venezuela and pretend that they're going after Iran. That's pretty pathetic.
Well, I think there's definitely an overblown aspect to this. Is it a New York Times article? But to say Hezbollah is running rampant in Venezuela, I don't think that the story actually goes that far. I think that's a bit of bluster on your part. But nevertheless, the idea that Venezuela must be bad because they have some kind of friendly relations with a friend of Iran, this is showing pretty much a knee-jerk kind of a scenario that you're trying to build up to discredit Maduro and build up this person who really should, according to Paul Craig Roberts, Maduro really should arrest Juan Guaido, the person who's being set up as if he's the president and only hasn't been elected. But I guess, you know, rule of law and elections and things, I mean, in the present day and age,
we don't need to stick in rule of law.
Yeah, let's not pretend, you know. We want this guy, we don't want this guy. To hell with what the Venezuelans think. This is what's going to happen because we're the big guys on the block and we have nukes and we can call the shots.
And we control the media and we can put out the message we want. The next slide, we see Greg Palast points out that this is a race thing in Venezuela. It's basically this white, they think of themselves as white, the so-called self-appointed white minority trying to get back power from the increasing mestizo majority, which elected Hugo Chavez, supported the Bolivarian Revolution, and is still supporting Maduro. And yet our media won't tell us that because, you know, they hate white supremacy. They hate the whites in America. They hate the whites in Europe. So if they tell us that this is the whites in Venezuela that they support, they're going to confuse us.
Well, we do live in the Western Hemisphere, and the Western Hemisphere since 1492 has been subject to, you know, what is without a doubt the most ruthless, consistent, unrelenting colonization of any part of the world by another part of the world. I'd like to just take a look at all the history of Native American members of, you know, the presidential teams and Congress. I notice the United States is quite, you know, supersedes and overcomes these kind of dastardly patterns that you're seeing in Venezuela, and Greg Palast wants to point out, whereas the United States is some kind of paradise when it comes to this issue, right?
Oh, yeah, naturally. Well, moving on, Ellen Brown will, again, be coming on my show tonight to talk about how this myth that, oh, it's terrible inflation, those darn socialists in Venezuela, they just print money and that causes inflation. And we have to keep our banks controlled by the plutocrat cabal, or else this might happen to us. Well, she'll blow that myth out of the water on my show tonight. And she'll talk about modern monetary theory, MMT, which is being pushed by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and actually has a shot at really changing things, creating a Green New Deal, things like that. So that should be really interesting. But, Tony, we're not quite on schedule, especially if you're going to talk very much about your great schedule. We're almost there. So let's move on to Occupy.
No, come on. Let's talk about Ellen Brown, and she's going to be on the show tonight, but not everybody's going to be
listening. You're going to call in tonight. Aren't you going to call in?
I don't know. The odds aren't that great that I will, but let's be clear that Ellen Brown's argument is that Venezuela has a great big debt. So they are creating more and more money, and this, you know, this is a part of what law, what has been proposed as a, you know, a good way of maximizing productivity in economy. You just put out as much money as you need to get things going to their maximum. But where it breaks down is when you have to pay a foreign debtor. So Venezuela has all this accumulated debt, so they have to sell their local currency in the international market to buy U.S. dollars. And this is where it all breaks down, and this is where the inflation becomes runaway. Canada had a Bank of Canada from the 30s until 1974 and financed a lot of its infrastructure development out of the Bank of Canada, which still has these powers, which, you know, Paul Hellyer, a former cabinet minister in the Trudeau government, makes a great deal of. So,
well, that's why you guys can afford national health care.
But then in 1974, Trudeau, for some reason, went along with the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland and joined the club. And so we're in the same dastardly system as all the others. But the Bank of Canada could still do this, apparently.
Well, if it did, maybe there would be a war on Canada to go along with the wars on Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, and let's move on to the war on Palestine. Maybe the nastiest of all of these. It's really a genocidal war of extermination against the Palestinian people and their culture. And so here's Netanyahu putting himself up on billboards next to Donald Trump in this election campaign that he's a little precarious right now because he's about to be indicted, but they're all a bunch of losers running against him. So who knows how that's going to come out?
Okay.
Next, Trump Israel. Build that wall. Build that wall. Well, that's what Israel's doing. They're not just walling in the so-called West Bank and destroying the lives of huge numbers of people in the process, but they're putting up a wall on the barrier of the Gaza Strip, the world's biggest concentration camp. They've already got the underground barrier stretching for how far is that? Like 65 kilometers or 40 miles, and they're building a 6-meter or 20-foot high wall along the course of that underground barrier. So they're really going to make sure that's a secure concentration camp that the Palestinians just can't get out of.
Well, just imagine the walls seem to be going up here, there, and everywhere, walled communities. The message from our media is be afraid, be very, very afraid, be very, very afraid of homegrown terrorists, this kind of terrorist, mm-hmm. that kind of terrorist. And lo and behold, those politicians who come up with proposals for walls end up being very popular. And I think if Trump has one election promise that he can really say, I promised this from the very beginning, and this had a tremendous reception in the United States, it was this wall with Mexico. And of course, we saw the lack of a really good wall between Gaza and Israel proper, what happened with all the murders of civilians in that situation. Anyway, this is going to quote unquote rectify the situation.
Well, you know, walls used to be politically unpopular. The Berlin Wall was so an atrocity, a crime against humanity, but these walls are okay, I guess. Depends on who's walling in whom. Well, how about the international observers being pulled out of Hebron? That's where Baruch Goldstein massacred. I forget how many many dozens of peacefully praying Muslims. And so there have been some international observers there ever since 1994, I guess it was. And now the Israelis just threw them out, maybe preparing another massacre for all we know.
Well, Hebron is a major Palestinian settlement, and there are at least a couple hundred thousand Palestinians in Hebron. There is a settlement with 800, Israelis living within that region. And this is only 30 miles away from Jerusalem, so they must be preparing the case for, you know, a larger Jerusalem, greater Jerusalem. Anyway, Netanyahu makes it clear that these international observers are to be taken out. These settler communities, are they vigilantes? You know, when the U.S. was pushing westward and eliminating the indigenous population in order to bring in a replacement population, a lot of the damage was done, the extermination was done by vigilantes. And so it is in the West Bank with settler populations. And right. to remove the international eyes and ears at this time under these circumstances is ominous.
Okay. Well, we just made it halfway through our list of stories. So we'll pick up the pace a little bit. But the next article we have to discuss a bit, which is this exploration of how it could be that this settler colony in occupied Palestine persists. How could a tiny population of fewer than 15 million Jews around the world take over the Holy Land of 4.5 billion Christians and Muslims? Well, basically because of their wealth. And so we have an article from Thomas Dalton, A Brief Look at Jewish Wealth, published over at the Occidental Observer, which is a sort of a white nationalist type of site. I don't really agree with their worldview, but they publish some interesting stuff. And this is worth talking about. Thomas Dalton goes over the history of all of the classic, writers who've talked about Jewish wealth and power, Cicero, Tacitus, Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, Immanuel Kant, pointing out that the wealth of the Jews apparently exceeds per capita that of any other nation. And that was in 1798. Today, of the 10 richest Americans, 50% or 5 of them are Jews. And it's a little more than that for the top 50, I guess. So basically, he's saying that if Jewish people happen to be about the half of the people at the top of the pyramid, you add that up, and Jewish people in the U.S. control about $50 trillion, half of the net wealth in the U.S. And that's quite astounding, and you can see why a population that's that incredibly rich and powerful, and it trickles down, too, because about almost half of the Jewish population makes six figures. Wow. that a population that wealthy and powerful has been able to manipulate nations and engage in this genocidal settler colonial project in occupied Palestine after all the other settler colonies are gone, right? White Rhodesia, Afrikaner South Africa, French Algeria, they've all gone home, packed up and gone home. But no, occupied Palestine, the genocide continues. This is why.
Well, let's put this in context. This study of how wealth is distributed, you know, this is a major theme of research in the academy, especially in the field of sociology. And it's very important to see, you know, who are the poor people in society? Who are the poorest? And, you know, there's a great deal of research to look into that. When it comes to looking at who are the richest and to give it a sort of ethnic identification, well, this gets controversial, and then, you know, the usual charges from the usual suspect come up about
you're telling the truth. You're telling the truth. You must be a hater.
I'm trying to point out that when it comes to looking at who's poor, nobody says that's racist. How dare you? Mm. You know, point to this group and that point. It might be, you know, it might hurt their feelings to be pointed out how poor they are. Mm. So the other side of that, if they're so poor and the so little wealth gets to the, you know, the blacks, the Hispanics, the Native Americans, the colored people of the whole world, whatever it might be. Then who has the wealth? So I want to, you know, put this in its context. I must say the concept of the Occident, I find this a very useful idea. I mean, there's Orientalism. Edward Said has this book, Orientalism. And we come to know that this is how social scientists sort of look at and stereotype about something called the Orient. But he's mostly interested in the near Middle East. Edward Said himself, who's a Palestinian American. But the other side of, if we're going to talk about Orientalism, it's perfectly legitimate to talk about Occidentalism.
No, that's so what's not what the opposite? Is, Tony. That's not the same thing, because Orientalism is Western people studying the Orient as an other and in order to colonize it, whereas the Occidental observer is a rabidly pro-Western, pro-white, you know, white nationalist type of operation. So it's not the same thing.
Well, anyway, I'm giving some sense of where the terminology comes from, and there are those who would say, well, I'm, you know, based in the East, and I'm going to study the Occident. I'm going to study how these this particular historical construction of people deal with things.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I get really antsy, and I don't like the term, you know, white identity, white culture. I mean, this is an invention. And white, well, there's a few albinos around. I was in Uganda and I saw an albino black man. Like, you know, all kinds of people can be white albinos, but people who aren't albino were all kinds of different shades and whatnot. So the idea of the Occident seems to me takes the sting out of it. But putting the adjective white puts a sting in it. And I just really don't want to be identifying that as some kind of really legitimate concept. Talk about Europeans. I know that's fine, although it becomes increasingly difficult to talk about Europeans. Seems to me the Occident has always been a kind of multicultural place with all kinds of people part of the construction of the Occident. And I wish we'd get terminology that we could talk about this. On the other hand, the idea that groups get to talk about their own self-interest and their own identity, other groups do it. Now it seems, you know, so people who want to call themselves white do it. Well, why should that be so obscene when other people do it? There's a certain logic to that.
Yeah, that's what Kevin MacDonald says. He was just on my radio show last week. And I think some of his points are legitimate, others less so. But let's move on to the clash of Occidental white European culture with natives in Canada. And Tony, we are running behind, so we can't do the justice to this amazingly detailed article, which should have been, it could be published in a scholarly journal. This is quite, your article is the next one after this.
Yeah, well, let's concentrate on this one and less so on the next one. This is a huge story that just broke yesterday in Canada. Here's the Globe and Mail, which is like the New York Times. And this is Jody Wilson Raybould. And her father, Bill Wilson, is a major quack, quack, we walk politician. That is a quack, quack, we walk politician. I used to read about the term, I'd pronounce it quacutal. And, you know, Franz Boas studied these people, and they make totem poles and fantastic art. And, you know, the West Coast people of North America, Northwestern North America, have a huge stake in sort of global civilization.
Yeah, yeah, they invented the potlatch.
And the potlatch. So yeah. Here was Justin Trudeau. One of the most enlightened things he did was, I think, appoint Jody Wilson Raybould, a quack, quack, we walk elected official in Vancouver, to the job of Attorney General of Canada, the government's top law enforcement officer. And she was recently taken out of that position, and let's call it what it is, a demotion. She was demoted to Veterans Affairs. And this was kind of a disappointing conclusion to what would she do in this job. And so it turns out that she stood up to, according to the Globe and Mail and these unnamed sources, an effort to hold back the law from taking a major company in Quebec, SNC-Lavalin, which is kind of like a Canadian version of Halliburton, a major company in Quebec, and Quebec takes care of its companies, and they have this place in Quebecois nationalism. The other big company is Bombardier, which makes Skidoos and then makes airplanes. These companies are well taken care of by government. And so the Trudeau government, so the story goes, was trying to hold back corruption charges arising from their effort to bribe people in Libya around Muammar Gaddafi. And they were putting pressure on the attorney general, the Guakwakwiwak attorney general. And she doesn't tell the story in the Globe and Mail article. Other sources tell the story, but she doesn't deny it. So suddenly this is has the making of a huge scandal for Justin Trudeau.
Could it bring him
as
down?
We're approaching the election? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's illegal to do what has been charged was done. Mary Ellen Terpel, who is overseeing, you know, this group studying Indian residential schools, she pointed out, she's a lawyer, that this is illegal to interfere in the application of justice in this way. So here's a Canadian story that just broke yesterday. And you say, you know, it's making all there's all this complexity in it. This is the first day. So anyway, that's...
Well, the real complexity is in our next slide, which is this great art piece that you just published on First Nations and pipeline politics in Canada. Bottom line is that there's still this huge conflict between Aboriginal and Crown title in land that is incredibly resource rich. And this is a huge, important power struggle. And really, you know, is Canada a really civilized place that maybe someday we'll be able to say it treated its natives better than, let's say, the U.S. did? It hinges on this.
Well, there's all this fossil fuel resources in Alberta, where I'm in Alberta right now. And much of this is owned by the Koch brothers. And there's a dearth of pipeline capacities to get this landlocked stuff to the West Coast and to the Orient. I did talk earlier about Canada's role in the international community to play off China against the United States. Having access to the West Coast with all this fossil fuels is very important. But British Columbia came into Canada as a colony, as a developed colony with its own policies, which didn't include recognizing Aboriginal title. So that title has not been recognized to this day. So unlike in most of Canada, where there are Crown Aboriginal treaties, there are no such agreements in British Columbia where they want to push these pipelines through. And there's great complexity to this issue. And this is sort of my academic specialty. And if you would like to go to this article, you know, I'd appreciate it. It's on American Herald Tribune, which is deplatformed from Facebook and and other platforms. Why? Because we're too good. And so, yeah. You know, we have to be pushed to the side. So getting to this article, which will be linked to in the, you know, our very important fact that we do publish our sources, and it has an academic element because we do that. You don't have to take our word for it. And we do write things, and we are both inclined to put up things that we write and call attention to it here, and that's what I'm doing now.
Yeah, and Tony, we should do a radio show on these two stories that you offered, because I think there's plenty, more than enough material for an hour's conversation on this.
Oh, Canada, our home on native land.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, something interesting actually happens in Canada. That's called Canada, right? Let's move on to New York and the capital of the universe. At least that's what the New Yorkers all think. Here we have the New York Times smearing Jeremy Corbyn, saying Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez should distance herself. Instead of, you know, high-fiving with him like she did, she should be spitting on him for being an evil anti-Semite. Man, the New York Times, sometimes they're okay, but they publish so much of this crap. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, it's amazing that Jeremy Corbyn has survived the assault directed at him. And, you know, he's in the position that Tony Blair once had. And Tony Blair really screwed up social democracy, sort of the left aspect of the political spectrum, when he had the power and he sort of continued Thatcher's positions. Jeremy Corbyn is a real left-leaning politician. And in my view, his propensity is to treat people as equals around the world, regardless of their background, their color, and whatnot. And he doesn't adhere to the kind of supremacist obedience that seems to be some people unnamed, because I wouldn't want to have the same kind of accusations put on me.
They could try to hound you, Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, wait a minute.
They could hound you out of your job at False Flag Weekly News.
Yeah, it already happened. Anyway, so
not at False Flag Weekly News.
Jeremy Corbyn is a kind of mensch, you know, which is a Hebrew or Yiddish for kind of solid stand-up guy.
He's a mensch, all right.
And, you know, and
a lot of Hebrew speakers wouldn't agree with that.
Some have criticized him for going too far, for sort of compromising with all of this. You know, you have to change the policy. Yeah, it's Yiddish.
Yiddish.
But you know, maybe it's
Tony. We can't give language lessons here. We got to get moving. We're
some of Yiddish is drawn from Hebrew, and it's also drawn from German because they were living so close together.
Okay, we don't need the linguistic lesson. Let's jump on to blackface. And more scandals. Okay. We have all kinds of wonderful scandals and smears going on. And one of them is Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, who has a college yearbook picture of blackface. And now Mark Herring, his Virginia state attorney general, was in blackface in college. All these stupid frat boy. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be bigoted against frat boys. But that type of person in college, they do some of these stupid things. They drink too much. They act racist. When I was a punk rocker, I actually got beat up by a gang of frat boys once. So I have a right to be prejudiced. Anyway,
okay, I'm going to comment on this. You're not going to push me off this one. Okay, the original blackface, Al Jolson in Mommy. Al Jolson happened to be Jewish, by the way. But anyway, the first talkie ends with the blackface Al Jolson singing Mommy. The first major motion picture, Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith, is a laudatory tale of the Ku Klux Klan saving the day from tyrannical blacks. You know, the first talkie and the first motion picture do these now, you know, very disreputable things. The United States is quite the place, and it's pretty confusing to live there, I would imagine.
They began with pro-Klan propaganda, and now they're doing pro-Zionist propaganda. They haven't really gone very far. Well, speaking of blackface, which is all such a scandal, these politicians must resign for blackface. What about Sacha Baron Cohen? I guess he has Jewish privilege, so he can do Arab and Muslim blackface in the same way, and nobody even notices.
Okay.
And how about, speaking of Arab-Muslim blackface and Islamophobia, a second former radically, rabidly anti-Muslim Dutch politician from the PVV party has converted to Islam. This is Joram van Klaveren, following the earlier conversion of what's his name? The other guy who converted to Islam. He probably has a new name by now anyway. So anyway, Allahu Akbar!
Well, Kevin, you might be verging on hubris here. This might be a little triumphalism on your part.
All right.
Maybe this story isn't as important as you make it out.
Maybe
not.
So let's move on to the next story then. How about the Tulsi time? We're living on Tulsi time. Okay, speaking of Islamophobia, the Democrats have to get rid of it, according to this story in Daily Sabah. And the one person they mentioned that is Islamophobic in the Democratic Party is Tulsi Gabbard, who has echoed, you know, Trump's rhetoric on saying we got to talk about radical Islam, you know, beating up on Obama and all that stuff. But now Tulsi is the peacenik. And the next slide, we see that she just tweeted that as commander in chief, she's running for president, she will work to end the Cold War nuclear arms race and the slide into nuclear war. That sounds good to me. But the media doesn't like this. Now the media is smearing and slandering her. In the next slide, we see NBC News is saying she's relying on this firm that was fabricating Russian data for the Democrats, blah, blah, blah. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian plant. Well, she may be a slight Islamophobe, but frankly, she looks better than most of the competition to me. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I think the Democratic Party, if it wants to deal with Islamophobia, has to deal with the lies and crimes of 9/11 and false flag yes. terrorism more generally. And that is the greatest remedy for Islamophobia, which is rampant, plague-like in the world. That is how people's minds became contaminated. And if we were to tell the truth about what we don't know everything about 9/11, but we certainly know it wasn't Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and 19 guys with box cutters. That's the real remedy. Now, as for Gabbard, who is quite an interesting subject, the next line in her Twitter that has this YouTube aspect, she says the phrase, and I'd like you to help me deconstruct this. It says, "I will end," says Tulsi Gabbard, "I will end the regime change wars that have taken far too many lives, cost trillions of dollars, and undermined our security by strengthening terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS." It's exactly true. Mm-hmm. It's exactly true that these organizations have been built up, you know, with U.S. financing and such. And so they have been strengthened. So it's a very apt thing to say. And she actually sponsored a bill saying we shouldn't be providing money to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so it seems to me that she is talking sense in a very intelligent way.
She might even be inching towards 9/11 truth, which is a very strange position for a supposed Islamophobe. But we got to move on to the next category about Google. Their motto is supposed to be don't be evil, but they changed it. They got rid of the don't. So now it's just be evil. And here they are using AI to target drones. Of course, drone killings are just a horrendous slaughter around the world, especially in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and elsewhere. Do you have anything really brief to say about that, Tony?
No, I think I'll talk for half an hour on the subject. No, what I have to say is this is about war. AI here, it's about, you know, drones, it's about war. And AI starts with war games, and it's going to always be that. And it's so very dangerous. It's beyond calculation how dangerous it is. Elon Musk, a big plutocrat, he's drawing our attention to the dangers of AI.
Right on. That Tony, that was the greatest succinct comment I could even imagine. Top high five.
Okay.
All right. No, that was really good. Couldn't have said it better. All right, moving on to the next story. This is our last serious story.
Oh.
Oh, man, I know. We have a couple of goofy stories at the end, the Hitler stories, the Nazi sausage stories. So stay tuned for that. Don't stop the video. Okay, here we have black helicopters swarming Los Angeles in an urban warfare drill. I don't know. Are they going to put us in Walmarts?
Bring in Jim Fetzer.
Yeah, we got to get Fetzer to talk about this.
This is not my forte.
And then finally, now this is next one is the last serious story. This is pretty scary. Sabrina Bittencourt, who was under witness protection in Spain after blowing the whistle on this horrific human trafficking operation in Brazil that Bill Clinton visited, where they keep huge numbers of sex slave women and murder them after they're forcibly impregnated, and the babies are then sold for up to £40,000 in Europe, the USA, and Australia. And this witness just was suicided. This is kind of, I don't know, it makes you wonder.
Pass.
Okay, finally, the Nazi sausages category. We finally made it, Tony, and we're pretty much on time to talk about Hitler lookalikes and Nazi sausages. How about this character, Neil Holmes? He's making over $4,000 per hour as a Hitler imitator. I think we got into the wrong profession.
Well, one of his jobs was to imitate Hitler in apparently a wedding reception where Winston Churchill would have a discussion with Hitler. And I would say that the place to look for the real serious source on that would be the scholarship of David Irving. This idea that he made $4,000 an hour, well, it says he made £500 for a 10-minute job. I think you're kind of exaggerating the $4,000 an hour. But Kevin Barrett, exaggerate. Kevin Barrett do jokes in bad taste? Oh, couldn't happen.
No way. Well, hey, £500 an hour for 10 minutes work, and it didn't just happen once. It's he can make that. That's his earning potential.
Yeah, but so you don't get to line up the 10 minutes in one in one row and just go.
Well, if anybody wants to pay me £500, which is like $700 or something for 10 minutes work, I'll consider that I'm making $4,000 an hour. So, hey, any takers out there?
Oh, this is serious subject that deserves serious discussion.
Speaking of serious subjects, how about
this lighthearted repartee?
Okay, let's move on to the final slide. The German Sausage Museum that was slated to move next to the Buchenwald concentration camp site has changed its mind. They're going to have a sausage museum elsewhere. So I guess displays like this swastika will no longer be offered at Buchenwald, which will, of course, warm the hearts of all of the Holocaust religion adepts.
Kevin, your taste in selecting this story as the final lighthearted joke story is abominable. Abominable. And I do not sanction it.
Well, Michael O'Donohue was a major influence on me. He was a satirist with the National Lampoon who did the satire Children's Letters to the Gestapo. And, I guess I was influenced by that at an early age. So okay, shoot me or gas me or whatever.
There are extenuating circumstances. I'll give you that.
Okay. Well, thank you, folks, for sticking with us to the bitter end of our German sausage Nazi concentration camp story. You've survived another episode of False Flag Weekly News. I'm Kevin Parrott with Professor Anthony Hall, trying to keep a sense of humor amidst the horror and chaos out there. So have a great week. See you next time. And see you, Tony. Thanks for coming on. Look forward to doing a lot more shows with you.
Cheerio.
Okay. Salaam alaikum.